one question that you have gotten about Everest?
The major question from everybody was, hey, did you get stuck in the lineups? I can't believe you paid to go on a trip and stand in the lineup, you know? And there's, so I got a lot of that because the mainstream media, basically. So I've been trying to do my best to defend what Everest was for me anyways, because I didn't experience any of that anywhere on the mountain. I was very fortunate. I didn't have lineups anywhere. And a lot of that is because of the freedom that Mi'kmaq gave me and allowed me to basically climb by myself at my own pace and everything. So, you know, I was fortunate. Like even my, all my climbs to the ice fall, I managed to get ahead of groups and pass groups. And, you know, I think that was pretty much the theme everywhere on the mountain for me. So I tried to tell my story because my story wasn't anything like what you see in the press right now.
Thank you for listening. This is the Success with Srini podcast. My name is Srini Saripalli and I'm your host. I'm a student of success. And on this podcast, I interview people who are amazingly successful in doing what they do. They are common people like you and me, and they are doing uncommon things. Not only that, they love sharing their story to impact the lives of others in a positive way. Today, my guest is Clayton Matthews, who is joining all the way from Vancouver, Canada. Clayton is an incredible climber who just summited Mount Everest. He was our expedition leader. I had to call off my summit, and I could only get to Camp 2 on Mount Everest. Clayton got to the summit effortlessly. At least, that's how I think. On this podcast interview, I ask him about things like, what is the life of a climber beyond Camp 2? Because I could not go beyond that point. How he climbed from Camp 4 onwards, his opinion on the traffic jam on Everest, and what should the climbers do, what should the expedition companies do, and what should the Nepal government should do. How to prepare for Everest, if you thought about climbing or if you're thinking about climbing Everest, and how has his life changed after summiting Everest. Clayton joined me via his phone while he was traveling, so the audio quality of this recording is a bit low, but I'm sure that you will love the content. So let's jump in and pick the brain of Clayton Matthews. Clayton, thank you for taking time. This is an amazing moment for me that we are back on the ground and we are having this conversation. Thank you for taking time. Thank you for joining. I am looking forward to this interview that had been since the first time I connected with you and I texted you saying, you know, would you be open to the podcast? And since then, I'm eagerly waiting for this. So thank you for doing this for me and for all of us.
Hey, no problem.
Thank you. Clayton, you were, you know, my expedition leader. And I saw your leadership, I saw your performance, and I want to kind of go not only just the Everest part, and you know, you are an incredible climber, you have done incredible things, but then I want to get to know the real Clayton, what made him who he is, those initial beginnings, then the life that Clayton has gone through, the experiences of life. So I have a wide area of thinking in my mind in how I want to approach this conversation today. So I want to start out by saying congratulations, climbing Mount Everest, not easy. The reason why I say that is because, you know, I tried and I failed. You know, let's use that word failure for a second here in a good way. I learned a lot, but I couldn't do it. Being there for 2 months and watching you the way you approached it, incredible for me looking outside in. And your commitment to your sponsors, your commitment to your followers, your commitment to other team members, your commitment to the overall project was absolutely incredible. So if a media does an interview of you and they talk to you, they will probably ask you from a different viewpoint. And I'm seeing you what you have done. Hats off to you, my friend.
Well, thank you very much.
So let me ask you this. What is the primary reason why you went to Everest? Start from there.
Well, it's the tallest mountain on the planet. So if you climb mountains, you generally gravitate towards the biggest one. Some people don't. Some people like technical climbing, so they gravitate towards the most technical mountain, which would be, you know, climbing in Patagonia or something in the Alps. But for in general, most mountaineers want to climb big mountains. So I just kind of gravitated towards Mount Everest. And I've had Mount Everest on my radar probably since 2015, I guess. Like I really wanted to go on my 40th birthday, but I just couldn't put it together. No matter what I did to try and make it happen, just nothing fell into place. And then I kind of got sidetracked on a few other mountains and a few other personal things. And then it didn't really work out with work. And then this year I had two friends that offered to come. They actually asked me to come with them, and I actually wanted to go in 2020, and I said, okay, sure. And I ended up making it happen. And then those two guys dropped out, and then I ended up just joining the team by myself and ran into all you guys. And it was actually ended up being great.
Wow. You know, I want to tell you something, that when we all got together, like I was like looking at all the other climbers, and I was thinking, man, if I have to emulate a climber, and I want to emulate the mannerisms of a climber on this trip, then the Clayton is the guy. You know, I was thinking that was my second thought. I don't know what my first thought was when I met you, but my second thought was that. And I'll tell you something, in the entire 2 months, you know, there was never a third thought like, okay, maybe I'll just go and emulate somebody else. Like, you never did anything. And this is the test of a leader, by the way. And you never did anything for me to question my second thought. And I want to ask you, did they select you as the expedition leader? How does that work? When I landed there, they said, your expedition leader is Clayton. Okay. So how does that happen? What's the process for that?
So actually, like, there just needs to be a name on the permit. I actually was one of the first people in Nepal. I was one of the first ones to arrive. Kaval was already there.
Hmm.
And Kaval was climbing Lhotse as well. And so Rishi decided to put him on the Lhotse permit and then decided to put me on the Everest permit. So I actually just lucked out and that way.
How naive I am. So I landed there and I said, if this guy is the expedition leader, so he probably has, you know, like climbed every mountain there is. When I started talking to you, and you climbed Denali, right? You climbed Aconcagua. You started telling me those things. I said, man, he has climbed so many mountains. And guess what happened? You know, somewhere along the way, while you were in a higher camp, and once we got to base camp and we did the rotations, in one of the rotations you were up, and I was in the base camp because I was not feeling well. And there was a paper that I saw in the dining tent that had the names of all the climbers and also had the date of birth of all the climbers. Mm. And I saw, man, Clayton is so young, much younger to me. And he has climbed all these mountains. And he told me Aconcagua, he told me about Denali. But let me ask you, where did you start? What mountains did you climb before you built this tenacity or whatever the right word is to go climb Mount Everest?
So I didn't start climbing until 2012. So since 2012, I've climbed a lot. And I took a mountaineering course in 2012. I came straight out of that and took a guided trip in Mount Rainier. So my very first mountain I climbed after my mountaineering course was Mount Rainier. And I learned a lot from the guides at IMG. And I actually climbed with IMG quite a bit afterwards. But then I also joined the Alpine Club of Canada and the British Columbia Mountaineering Club. And through those two clubs, you know, I climbed with a lot of other good climbers, and you know, they kind of took me under my wing, and I went on a lot of trips, like club trips, but also they took me on, you know, private trips that was outside of the club. I was a really big mountain biker before that for like, you know, 12 years. So all I did was downhill mountain bike, and then as soon as I started climbing, you know, my bike is still hanging on the wall. I haven't hardly touched it at all, and I pretty much dedicated everything I had to climbing, whether it was mountaineering, ice climbing, rock climbing. I just wanted to learn and get better, and it eventually led me towards Everest.
That's it, huh? So just 5 years, 6 years?
Yep.
Wow. And nothing else in the beginning, like when you started, like cool in the college?
No. So I work in construction. So, I mean, you know, I was scaffolding, and so there's a fair bit of, like, you know, climbing there, but it's a job, but you know, that's all I really ever did. And in terms of like anything close to climbing, I never rock climbed before that. I never, you know, I never tried it, never did anything until I took a mountaineering course, and then I was hooked. And I climbed a ton. I put every cent I had and every spare moment I had into climbing.
Right. So let's see. So Rainier is the starting point. A little bit a formal training before that. And then what are the other mountains after that? Like, what are the big peaks?
So the major peaks after that, I climbed Mount Whitney, Mountaineer's Route, Shasta from two sides. I did the Hotland Bolam and I did the normal route.
Mm-hmm.
I tried the Castlevall Ridge solo, but yeah, the snow conditions were horrible. I ended up having to turn around probably like 3/4 of the way up.
Wow.
And then Mount Hood, Mount Adams, a lot of the Cascade volcanoes, pretty much all of them.
Wow.
Except for the only ones I haven't climbed are Glacier Peak and the Three Sisters in Oregon.
Wow.
But basically from Lassen all the way up to Squamish, which is Mount Garibaldi. That's the whole Cascade volcano range. I only got like four more to climb, and I've climbed all of them.
Wow.
But yeah, so I basically started out from the high peaks, like in terms of altitude, was, you know, the Cascade volcanoes. And then I got a job in Mexico, and I was working on the Baja for a bit. And then so naturally there's the Mexican volcanoes. So I went and climbed Ecstasy Waddle and then Pico de Orizaba.
Mm-hmm.
And then the year after that, I went to Nepal. I climbed Lobache, Island Peak, and Ama de Blam. And then the year after that, I went down to Ecuador. I climbed the Ecuador volcanoes. I climbed Kiambe, Cotopaxi, Antisana, Chimborazo, Illanizza Norte, and Illanizza Sur. So I climbed six volcanoes there in 3 weeks, just over 3 weeks. And then from that, I went straight to Aconcagua. I climbed Aconcagua and then came home. That was a good, you know, just over 2 month trip.
So I thought after listening to all that, this is my motion. This is my raw emotion. So I thought that I was a little stupid when it comes down to like my list of climbing accomplishments. But after listening to your list, Clayton, I feel like I'm an idiot, honestly. Like how can you go from seriously? Like, I took like seven attempts to climb. The seventh time I climbed Shasta. But I climbed the mountainous route of Whitney. I was good. And on that day, it was you know, one attempt, Whitney. But none of this level of depth and this wide experience and doing this in such a short time. Now, that leads me to ask you, you know, when you landed there in Nepal and for this expedition to climb Everest, were you feeling that, man, I have all the right experience and I have what it takes to go climb this? Because we'll talk about something that you shared with the media, and you were the fastest to go from Camp 4 to the summit, and we'll talk about that in a second. From your understanding, you knew from the beginning that you were going to be like, you are well trained and well equipped, right?
Yeah, so I've climbed a fair bit in the Rockies, the Canadian Rockies as well. And the Rockies are known for what's called CHOS, which is bad rock. And I've climbed quite a few technical routes there. I've climbed technical routes even along the coast mountains here, close to Squamish. And in Seattle, or in Washington State. So, you know, I've climbed quite a bit of technical climbing. So in terms of rock, snow, ice, I knew that. I studied the route on Everest quite a bit, and I knew there was nothing there technically that I couldn't climb.
Wow.
You know, all I had to do was deal with the altitude, have good weather, have good luck in terms of, you know, crowds and whatever. And I was pretty confident that I could make it happen as long as I took care of myself. I didn't get sick and I could deal with the altitude. You know, I'd been to 7,000 meters on Aconcagua and I was great. I actually was part of a rescue right from the summit.
Yeah.
So I was fairly confident that I'd be okay, you know, and I got a lot of questions about, you know, have you climbed an 8,000er before, you know, and you're at Everest and, you know, I kind of felt like people thought that maybe I wasn't qualified to be there because, you know, we had a pretty strong base camp. There's a lot of people that had previous 8,000 meter peak experience and I didn't have any, you know, but I was still pretty confident I'd be able to hold my own on the mountain, you know, is because, you know, I've climbed a lot and I've climbed a lot harder technical wise mountains. So I figured, you know, I'd be okay.
Wow. Just the list of the mountains that you just shared is amazing. Yeah. No, I mean, you get down there, you go to the base camp and then, or you meet a lot of climbers in Nepal once you land there and you listen to all their stories and you like start questioning, wow, okay, you climbed Choyu, you went to Nanga Parbat, and I mean, you did all these 14ers, and I don't have that experience, and you know, you get intimidated by what's going on. I don't know, with my limited understanding on mountains, you know, on a given day, on that day, in those situations, in those circumstances, who you are matters. And the same climber on a different day is a whole different equation altogether. So what drives you, Clayton? What is the primary reason why? Is it statistics? Is it something more than that that drives you to go to these mountains? I'm sure you'll probably go back to Everest again, climb from north side, or I don't know. I mean, a lot of possibilities from this point now that this has happened. But what drives you? Like, what's the main core motivation?
I like things that are hard, so I like to, you know, I like to work hard. I'm not, you know, I've always, you know, in terms of actual work, I've always worked hard. So when I go to the mountains, I like a challenge. So I like physical work, you know, and I like, it's basically the challenge. And like, honestly, like when I climb with a lot of like fear, you know, like I'm actually afraid of mountains. So when I go there, it's like a big challenge for me. Like I have a lot of doubt sometimes, you know, and so it's just working through all that, you know, it's just a greater accomplishment when you actually get to the top after you've worked through all that. You know, I kind of make a bigger deal out of things and kind of come into some climbs kind of, you know, worried about this or worried about that. And, you know, when I'm on the mountain, I'm pretty observant. I can see a lot of things in terms of like where rockfall might be or crevasses. And so, you know, those things genuinely scare me. And so I've almost gotten nailed by rockfall probably like 10 times. So I'm kind of a rockfall magnet. I haven't actually been hit, but I've been really, 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 really close. So
when I'm climbing,
that's like when I climb fast, I'm not trying to be the fastest guy or set any record. I'm just trying to get up and get down, you know, like speed is safety. You know, a big part of it is safety. So, you know, and that's probably my number one thing that made this expedition so great is that I had a lot of freedom. Like Mi'kmaq was fantastic. Our Sherpa Siddhar, he was great.
Absolutely.
I could climb at whatever pace I wanted to, go whenever I wanted to, stay at whatever camp I wanted to. Like he was great. So like when you go into the ice fall, it's super dangerous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was easily an hour or so or more ahead of everybody. And that, you know, that's 1 hour that you're not stuck under hanging ice. You know, it was great. Yeah.
Right. So there was, remember from camp 3 to camp 4, they were talking about rockfall and all those things. Did you encounter, because I didn't go, so I have no idea. But did you encounter any rockfall there? You saw anything coming down or?
Not really. So like the yellow band is like, because you climb the Lhotse face and you traverse over to the yellow band.
Right.
And the yellow band is, you know, it's yellow limestone, but it's a softer type of stone. So it's generally polished. Like it's fairly smooth. There's no real broken lumps that could come off, you know, like, so I actually thought the yellow band was fairly safe. There's not a lot of loose rock on it. It's kind of more, cause it's so soft, right? Like it's kind of just buffed.
Right.
It's
right.
Like smooth.
Yeah.
Whereas Geneva Spur, there's a fair bit of loose rock on the Geneva Spur. And honestly, I think the worst spot on the whole mountain for rockfall on the south route would be just about, like, you know, halfway to the balcony. There's rock bands you have to move through there.
Okay.
There's loose rock everywhere on the steps. So, yes, there's people that can, you know.
Yeah. They can misstep.
That can kick. Kick rock or whatever. Yeah. But generally, everybody tries to be safe. I actually knocked some rock down, and it wasn't me stepping. It was actually the rope. So the fixed line is fairly loose to that section because it's, you know, it's not a straight slope. But there's, like, steps. So the when the fixed line kind of hangs high and it hangs low. And as you're walking, you're not walking in a straight line because rock band. So you're going to the right, you're going to the left and up and down. And then, so the rope is actually moving quite a bit. And so I snagged a loose rock that was kind of sitting on a ledge and it went down and it almost hit Lhakpa, who was below me. And so, you know, I suggested to Lhakpa to stay closer to me so that, you know, any rocks wouldn't gain momentum in case he did get hit. You know what I mean? It's actually safer to stay closer together when you have loose rock than it is to be spread out. Cause if you're spread out, the rock gains momentum and you get hit with a lot of force. So we kind of stayed tighter, you know, even though I was kind of tired near the bottom, Lhakpa was really good at staying with me. And so, yeah, we got through that section pretty easily, but you know, a lot of people don't wear helmets on summit day. And so, that's a really bad spot coming down for sure.
Yeah. So, I heard a lot of stories in the base camp about the rockfall and the people kicking and, you know, people slipping and then unknowingly kind of, you know, kicking the rock down.
as a result of that. Yeah. So I heard all that, but I was not sure whether any of our teammates encountered, because I haven't spoken to anyone since, with an exception that I spoke to Otto yesterday. But other than that, I haven't, and Jesh, of course, but then I didn't talk to anybody else. And those are our two team members. But you said Mingma. Mingma was our Sirdar. In fact, this is my second time that I'm with Mingma. I was with him he was our expedition leader at Himlung. I went about 6-8 months ago. And, I'll be blown away. I was in Khumbu, and he precisely told me that, Srini, I don't think you should go up. You're not well. You need to turn around. And he gave me some specific advice right inside Khumbu when I turned back. That's completely inked into my mind. Before even that, when we went to Camp 2, all of us, you stayed back in Camp 2 for one night. We came to Camp 1. And from there, the next day, we all came from Camp 1 down. You came from Camp 2 down. In fact, you crossed me right inside Khumbu when I was coming down. I was slow. But sleeping in Camp 2 for one extra day, did that help you in any way to acclimate better?
Absolutely.
And that was outside the norm, right? That was something that was not a part of the plan, and that was you deciding to sleep there for one extra night. So was it somebody who told you to do that, or was just that's your own internal, just you figured out right there and then?
I knew I had to sleep at Camp 2 as much as I possibly could. I think that most climbers should try to spend at least 3 to 4 nights at Camp 2 prior to going higher.
Even Elizabeth also told me the same thing. It's interesting that you say that. It's exact same words. 3 to 4 days, you got to sleep in Camp 2. It's amazing. You say the same. Wow.
Yeah. It's high. Like, you're over 6,000 meters then, right? It's like Camp 2, you're still 2,400 meters from the summit, but you're high. Like, over 6,000 meters is, a lot of people can't sleep there. And a lot, you've seen the helicopters, people are getting flown down, right? Like, so
yes,
you need to acclimatize solid to 6,000 meters before you really start pushing higher. If you want to be, fast and make sure that you're not going to be sick,
Going into the base camp, everybody's like, you need to acclimate to 5,200 meters. That's the baseline. That's when it's a fine line between when body, adjusts, at the same time body declines, and that's the midpoint. But then as we started going up, and I started realizing, everybody telling me, and now that you are saying that, Elizabeth told before, and I also felt the same thing, man, I went to 6,500, and that's, going in was so hard. But then you don't acclimate to that number, 65. That's what my personal observation was. Difficult to go up. And everybody there said, okay, if you're struggling at 6,500, if you put oxygen from that point, you should be okay. And I want to ask you, how did oxygen, what role? I think this is the first time you were on oxygen, correct?
Yes.
What's your experience?
It helps tremendously. And I probably could have used more.
Really? Man.
So there's two types of regulators. Ours were the lower flow ones, which are fine. They go from 0.5 to 4 liters per minute.
Mm.
The first summiters on our summit day, that was Kenton Cool's expedition.
Okay.
He had the high flow regulators. He must have had the lower ones for their base camp, but then switched regulators for their climb. High camp, right?
Okay, yeah, high camp.
Yeah, so like I'm pretty sure they were burning, 5 to 6 liters per minute easily. Like those guys had extra bottles placed along the route for them, right?
Hmm.
Like I'm pretty sure those guys probably used like 5 bottles on summit day. I used 2.
Wow. And your performance would have been better, energy would have been better, much faster.
Oh, yeah.
You got to the summit at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, probably like 6:30-ish, 20 after 6, something like that.
Okay, and the sunrise was there. You could see the whole thing, correct, when you got there?
Yeah, sunrise was, probably 20 after 5, probably an hour before that or so.
Okay, wow. So high flow, low flow oxygen, you would recommend high flow for higher altitude?
The higher flow you can run, well, you're gonna run out of oxygen. There's always that risk, but the higher flow you run at, the better you're going to feel and the faster you're going to move and you're going to stay warmer, right? So
yeah.
Oxygen definitely helps a lot. There's no way I could climb Everest without oxygen. I wouldn't even try.
You won't even try?
No, I wouldn't even try.
So Elizabeth, you know, and all the other people, they're doing something extraordinary, right? In your observation. Yeah. I saw the post that you made on Facebook. Yeah. And I felt the same way too.
And like when I seen Elizabeth, you know, for the last time in base camp there, and it was kind of surreal. It was me, her, Tim, and I, like,
right,
all talking about her summit plans and what she was going to do. And, you know, I didn't have much to really offer, but I just said, like, hey, you've made it to 8,500 meters before and had to turn around. And, like, if you get to the same spot again and you're thinking about having to turn around, I'm like, just use oxygen. I'm like, take a Sherpa. He'll carry a bottle for you. They're going to stay with you no matter how slow you are.
Yeah.
Just get to the top this time, you know? Like, how many times do you want to come back? Like, just try your hardest.
Right.
You can't do it. Use oxygen. Just get to the top and get down. At least you can say, hey, you've been to the top once.
Yeah. Amazing.
So I'm not too sure how her summit day turned out. I still haven't really heard, but
yes.
I know she made it, but I don't know if it was without oxygen or with oxygen or how she did. I know she did lots.
No, she did. In fact, I think Alan Arnett or someone, on some site I saw that she made it to both the peaks without oxygen. That's
good for her.
Yeah, that's awesome.
She
didn't tell precisely how she did it, or she didn't provide the narrative. I have not seen her narrative yet. I'm sure media has gotten up with her and they're interviewing her and all those things, but I've not seen anything that she said exactly what happened and how she did it and all those things. So I'm waiting for that to come out. I'm eagerly waiting for that. In fact, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from her story.
Absolutely.
Clayton, one of the questions, and I know that you are doing a lot of media interviews and all, and this is going to happen, continue and all. But then one of the questions I have gotten repeatedly multiple times about, you know, Everest. But I want to ask you, from all your friend circle and all your extended, you know, your professional circles, your extended friend circles, and from media, what's that one question that you have gotten about Everest specifically?
Well, I think because after the fact, there was so much traffic, you know, there's been such, you know, kind of bad press about, you know, those unfortunate few days where the viral picture came out of, you know, people standing in lineups and people dying because there's lineups, you know, so there's all that bad press. And I didn't initially contact a lot of my friends right away and, you know, coworkers and everything. So, you know, the major question from everybody was, hey, did you get stuck in the lineups? Did you experience that? And I can't believe you paid to go on a trip and stand in the lineup, you know? And there's, so I got a lot of that because of, you know, the mainstream media basically. So I've been trying to do my best to, you know, defend what Everest was for me anyways, because I didn't experience any of that anywhere on the mountain. I was very fortunate. I didn't have lineups anywhere, and a lot of that is because of the freedom that Mi'kmaq gave me and allowed me to basically climb by myself at my own pace and everything. So, you know, I was fortunate. Like even all my climbs to the ice fall, I managed to get ahead of groups and pass groups, and, you know, I think that was pretty much the theme everywhere on the mountain for me. Even on the summit day, like I came out of Camp 4 and I got ahead of everybody. And then as soon as I was ahead of everybody, I just cruised to the summit and cruised down. And, you know, I didn't have any real major issues. So, yeah, so I tried to tell my story because my story wasn't anything like what you see in the press right now, right? So
Yeah. No, I just made a post on my blog and I was talking about the same. I shared the photo. Now that photo has become extremely viral. I said, Clayton Matthews went up and he didn't face any of these things. In fact, I think you said you crossed over the fixed line and used your ice axe to go up, correct?
So I don't know if I was like the first one or second one out of our camp. I think actually Otto was ahead with Mi'kmaq. Slightly ahead out of camp. We passed him just before we got to the first fixed line. And so the first fixed line was still pretty low slope, so, you know, Lakhba and I didn't even clip into it. And then we got to about the third fixed rope section. And there was a group there. It was probably a group of, you know, four people. And they were moving a little bit and then stopping and then moving a little bit. So I never even actually clipped into that one. Wow. Or sorry, I clipped into it behind them, noticed they were super slow, unclipped right away, passed them, and then clipped back into the line, got up to the next group, and followed them for quite a while. And then it was actually Lakhba who kind of like tapped me on the shoulder. He's like, come on to this side. And he's like, if you want to pass him, let's pass him. So he kind of like hand signaled around, you know, like a curved hand, like finger, like just go around him. So,
right. So
I passed that group as well, but on the right-hand side this time, the time before I was all on the left-hand side. So I was already on the other side of the rope and that, you know, I passed, I passed that second group on the right-hand side of the rope because, you know, most people are right-handed, so pretty much everybody was climbing on the left-hand side of the rope. So I was on the right. I was, like, the only one on the right-hand side, and then the slope started to get steeper, so I got Lakpo to pull my ice axe off my pack, and I pulled his out, and then we unclipped from the rope to pass the next group because it was a pretty big group. It was like eight people, so as soon as the front person stopped, they all stopped, and then that's when we scooted around them. And to pass eight people, you know, it's actually a long ways. It was fairly steep there, and it's over the rock band. So,
wow.
You know, I got around them, but I was winded. I was pretty much toast, so I slowed down a little bit. But I never ever did clip back into the line. I just grabbed a hold of the line with my left hand, and then, you know, I slowly gained my breath back, and I worked my way up to the next group, and then, you know, I'd trail that group, and then as soon as the front person would stop, I'd burn around them again, and then so that was kind of a pattern. And,
man,
and you know, like a good reasonable time from camp four to the balcony is, you know, 4 to 6 hours. I was up there in 3 hours and 10 minutes.
Wow.
And then, that's, you know, gosh. and then so after I got to the balcony, and there was a huge gap between, you know, that group of like say 40 climbers and then the lead group. So it was a combination of people who left super early, because some people left at like 7 and we left at 9. And then there was, wow, Kenton Cool's group who was on the high flow oxygen. So, you know, there was no catching those guys. Like, they're not even close. I wasn't even going to try. And wow, because I had such a huge space in front of me, there was no traffic, no nothing. So I just slowed right down. I just concentrated from that point. You know, I was kind of just setting goals. You know, I wanted to get to the South Summit. I got to the South Summit.
Mm-hmm.
Then I wanted to get to, or sorry, not the South Summit, the balcony. So, and I got to the balcony, and then the next goal was the South Summit. Yeah. And then I just concentrated on getting to the South Summit. And actually, as soon as you left the balcony, there's a bit of a ridge before you actually hit like the face of the south, going up to the South Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And that ridge was like probably the windiest and coldest spot of the whole climb.
The whole climb. Yeah. Yep.
Over the night, like, yeah, my whole left side just freezing there.
Oh.
And then as you climb towards the top of the South Summit, you get to like about 8,500 meters, and it steepens right up. That for me was the hardest part of the whole climb, was that last like 200 meters of the South Summit. It was steep.
Mm.
And then you get on the South Summit, and then you can see, you know, the Cornish Reverse, the Hillary Step, and the real summit. And then after that, it's like, okay, I'm going to make it. You know, like,
right,
it's,
right. That's when you that's when you realize, man, I'm like, this is real. Now this is happening.
Yeah.
Right.
It's right there. It's going to happen. You know, like, right. Still, you can see it, but it's still like from the South Summit to the summit, it's like, you know, it's a good hour, you know, so right. It's still pretty far away, but it was pretty cool. It's just starting to get light out, so you could see everything. It wasn't, the sun hadn't risen yet, but yeah, it was gorgeous. And it's only like one-way traffic. So that group was actually coming up, and I congratulated them because I had met Kenton in camp two.
Mm.
He's a friend of Tim's. So so I congratulated their group. And I think there was probably like 6 in that group. We passed another group coming down just shortly after that step, just before the Cornish Traverse. And that was probably the first group of, you know, the first summiters. But they would have summited in the dark because, you know, like they were 45 minutes from the summit, and it was just starting to get light out. So they couldn't have had, you know,
good pictures.
Yeah, not very many views from the summit for sure.
Yeah, and I know, and imagining that you ending up on the summit and unable to take photos, and I can't, you know, for all the listeners who are listening to this podcast or to this recording, you know, I want to tell them that you are an incredible photographer, and something that I don't think you're a trained photographer, correct?
No, I actually just got my camera like 3 months before the trip, so I
right,
kind of been playing with it a bit, and you know, I ski toured quite a bit all winter, so you know, I winter camped quite a bit when I was skiing, and so I took my camera with me wherever I went, and you know, I took, you know, a good 1,000 photos probably before I even got to Everest, so I got not too bad with it. But just before I left, I got a new lens, and I got my intervalometer, which, you know, lets you take long exposure photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of my night photos, the star trails and all that kind of stuff, like, I had just gotten that stuff before I left forever, so I hadn't played with it at all. So on my trek in and the whole hike up to base camp, but you know, I tried it out in Namche and tried it out in Lobuche and Dingboche, and so a lot of those photos that I took at night that had the cool star trails and stuff like that, I had never done it before, so it was kind of a bit of a learning curve, and it was really fun to do.
Yeah, and learning something at that high altitude is very difficult too, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, yeah. I packed a full-frame Sony camera all the way up to the summit, and then, you know, and because I was cruising so quickly on up to the balcony, I didn't take any photos there, and then as soon as I left the balcony, I hit all that wind, and, you know, I wasn't pulling the camera out then, and then when I got to the south summit, I was like, okay, well, there's a summit right there, and, you know, at that point, I probably could have taken my camera out, and I probably should have, but I just didn't want to make any mistakes. You know, you lose a glove, you lose a hand, you know, and I was so close, and I didn't want to, you know, ruin it. So I didn't take any photos between Camp 4 and the summit. I just took summit photos. And then on the way down, I was just concentrating on getting down because, you know, again, I'll say it again, I climbed with a lot of fear. So I was, you know, there's so many stories of people making mistakes on the way down. So I didn't want to make any mistakes. I didn't want to be that person. And then when I got to Camp 4, you know, I was really worried. I was checking my oxygen all the time. You know, you hear stories of people running out of oxygen and dying in their tents. You know, I didn't want to be that guy either. Like, we got slammed by wind in Camp 4, so we couldn't descend past Camp 4, so we were stuck in Camp 4. Yeah, so I just wanted to get down, you know, and when we did actually leave Camp 4 in the 17th, I went all the way from Camp 4 to base camp. We stopped in Camp 2, but I didn't stay in Camp 2. Like, everybody else stayed in Camp 2 for 2 nights.
Yeah, no, exactly, yeah. So you came down, and that's when you met Tim and Elizabeth, right?
I seen Elizabeth. Tim was already up. He was still up on Nepsi.
Oh, okay. It's an interesting thing that you say that if you would have had the high flow oxygen, that the whole thing would have been much more easier. Do you think you can handle wind differently if you are on high oxygen, or that has nothing to do with that?
I don't know about the wind, but it definitely would keep you warmer for sure. Like, you can handle cold, which is going to be the wind. The wind's going to make you colder, right? So, I mean, I would say you could probably take a little bit more wind, but I mean, wind is different. It depends on what angle it's coming at, and if there's a bit of snow in it, you know, or like, how much humidity is in the air. Because, like, some wind can be a lot colder than others, you know. Like, I've gotten to this top of mountains and been absolutely covered in rime ice because there was so much humidity in the air, and it was windy, that you literally become a human icicle, you know what I mean? Like, I've had the shaft of my ice axe been, you know, a good inch and a half diameter because it was covered in ice.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's different types of wind. It can be wind can be a lot colder than others, you know.
In fact, I went down, I descended from base camp, and when I came back up, I hit massive wind between Lobuje and Gorakship. Big time. And I felt, wow, this is crazy. You know, why is this happening now? And I'm like, it changed so fast. It was sunny. It was all that. And then boom, it changed. And, you know, it's like that happening in the high, in that altitude. Wow. It's crazy. It's just, and, you know, people, Lobuje, Gorakship, you know, that's some altitude. But then the whole thing, you know, it's a whole different level once you are above Camp 4. It's amazing. And I asked you, what's the common question that you get? No, let me tell you the common question that I have gotten consistently from people. And that is, how did you tell your wife that you're going to climb Mount Everest? That's a common question that I've gotten from many people, and I'm continuing to get that question. You know, and who are the people in your life, Clayton, that whom you had to convince that you were going on Mount Everest?
Everybody in my family. And my girlfriend, especially, like, she's supported me through everything for a long time. And so everybody's been following what I've been doing, climbing and everything. So everybody was pretty good with me going, actually. Like, there was the odd question, like, who are you going with? And what company are you going with? Mm-hmm. And, you know, are you going to be safe? And this and that, whatever.
Yeah.
There was those questions. But I never really had to convince anybody or get permission to go. Like, my girlfriend has always been supportive of me and through all my climbing. And so, like, she climbs a bit too and skis quite a bit, you know, and like, on a lot of my prior expeditions, you know, she's given me weather forecasts and messages me on my inReach. Like, I've got 3 or 4 major weather sites bookmarked on her, you know, on her browser, on her laptop. And I just ask for a certain forecast and she sends it to me. Like, she's pretty helpful and has been great and wasn't concerned about me going at all. She's seen me climb and she knows what I'm capable of, and she never really had any doubt that I would make it. It was pretty much the same, you know, doubts that I had in terms of, you know, weather and crowds and people and just, you know, stuff that you can't really control too much, right?
Right. Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But then, and the amount of faith people around you, they put in you, that builds up the self-esteem and a confidence in you. Of course, the preparation is important, but of course, their faith in you is also a big contributor towards making such a thing happen and the final outcome to be favorable. It does play a huge role, and their support, usually people don't credit them who stay behind you and never come to the forefront, but they're constantly supporting you. Someone who has been there, in at least not to the levels that you have been to, that I've been there, I've seen, and I can relate to the fact that their contribution to our success is a big player. It just, you know, without that, we just cannot go anywhere. You know, that's the truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. And hats off to them. We had some incredible team members. They all have achieved something amazing in this trip. Some of them summited, some of them couldn't, and people who could not, I was one among them. But is there, if somebody wants to climb, Clayton, based on this experience and based on all that you have accomplished, what is that one suggestion you give? And that is, you know, I'm asking that question not only from their side, but also from my side. What is your suggestion? Someone who wants to go climb Everest. Every climber will eventually at some point may have thought of climbing Everest, but they're not doing it. If they do want to do it, what is your suggestion? What's the plan? How they should approach?
Well, you can never be too fit and experience. So I'd say, you know, mountaineering is definitely important. You know, you need to know how to put your crampons on, how to walk on a glacier, how to walk on ice, how to front point. You know, walking with crampons on is a little bit different than actually just walking, you know, when you're climbing. So, you know, get used to your crampons, get used to mountaineering, you know, but mountaineering isn't everything. You know, if you can get out and do a little bit of rock climbing, go rock climbing, even if it's, you know, you don't have to lead, but even if you can find somebody that'll take you on a few rock routes and you can just follow, just get used to, you know, your footwork on rock, because, you know, climbing Mount Everest isn't just snow and isn't just ice. There's rock bands there. And so once you get used to rock climbing and knowing where to put your feet, and, you know, like, well, rock climbing, you know, you're always grabbing stuff with your hands, but actually rock climbing is, you know, 80-90% footwork, you know? So once you get used to placing your feet on rock and how to stem and how to do a lot of things on rock, then put your crampons on and start walking on, climbing on rock with crampons on, you know? So if you can do those things and practice it and go to the mountain fit as you can possibly go, you'll be successful. Like, Mount Everest is high, it's long, it's hard, but it's not super technical. So, I mean, if you can just go fit and go with some, you know, prior skills, rock climbing skills and mountaineering skills, you can do it for sure.
Amazing. I have two more questions to ask you. You posted on Facebook and you said life did not change. You are not the coolest guy. Your ego has not gone up. You are the same individual. And you didn't go up there for any of those things. And life has not, you know, is not different. Yet, life is different now that you have come down. So what is different, according to you, now that you have accomplished this? And it has nothing to do with name or fame or any of those things. But in what is different? At an intellectual level, maybe at a spiritual level, what is different?
Like, I don't have kids and I've never had that type of responsibility. And so for me, like, I just feel like I've achieved something finally in my life, and, you know, I have something to lose. You know, I've gone climbing a few times now since Everest, and I find myself being a lot more careful because I don't want to be that guy that dies on something that's super easy after climbing Everest. You know, like, I feel like I got something to be extra safe about now. You know what I mean? I don't want to lose that.
Wow. That's the lesson, more or less.
Yeah.
Right? That's the change in approach or thinking. That's amazing. Clayton, you know, I ask this question to everyone, whoever I get an opportunity to speak with, and just, you know, that I was learning from this conversation. Is there any question that you thought that I should have asked, or is it anything that you want to share that we did not discuss here, or did I miss anything, or something that's valuable to my listeners or anybody who listens to this?
Not that I can really think of. No, I think we covered quite a bit.
Okay, so I will listen to this recording, and I will have a few questions, a few follow-up thoughts. You were driving and you were traveling and you made time to have this conversation, to be on this podcast, which speaks volumes about you. And thank you for doing that. We had technical difficulties in getting this going and we got delayed and all that. But I will go. I will study this entire interview and I may have a few follow-up questions. And then I'm pretty sure that people will have a few follow-up questions, whoever will listen to this. And hopefully in a few weeks, maybe we'll have a follow-up conversation based on the questions that we get. Any closing comments?
There's one thing I can say about Everest and our climb is that, you know, again, back to all the negative press and, you know, there's too many people on Mount Everest and there's too much inexperience and, you know, Nepal's getting a bad rap. They should be limiting permits and all that. I just want to say that the what happened on those few days could have been avoided if some of the guiding companies had communicated to one another when they were actually going to climb, right?
I know
there was a windstorm. A lot of people didn't get their acclimatization in when they wanted to. So a lot of people didn't have the option to go for that first window that we did. But at the same time, there was companies that made the conscious choice to not go until the second window because they have always had better weather after the 20th, you know, so they were never, ever looking to go early. And, you know, everybody's, there's like three or four major forecasting companies out there. Everybody had a slightly different forecast. So some guys' forecasts are saying this day is going to be good and that day is going to be good. But overall, between all three forecasts, it was only a day or two difference, but the windows are roughly the same in everybody's forecasts. One of the problems, though, is that with that 23rd and 24th forecast, by the time they had to leave base camp to hit those days, in that same forecast, the long-range forecast didn't show a third window at that time. So those people didn't really have a choice to go for a third window because it didn't really show in their forecast. And do you gamble and not go when you got all these high-paying clients? So, I mean, I can see how they got kind of forced into all going at the same time, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But it's not Nepal's fault for issuing too many permits. It's just that the people climbing the mountain didn't manage themselves properly. And like, really, do you want Nepal to tell you which days you can climb on? Like, that's not going to work. So I don't see that limiting permits could have changed really what happened on those 2 days.
They put in the new requirement where you have to climb an 8,000 meter peak before climbing almost 9,000 meter peak, which is Everest. Then, you know, I am disqualified, and I've just heard from talking to you.
I would have been disqualified.
You would be disqualified,
I haven't climbed an 8,000er before.
Yeah. I completely overlooked the fact that the long-range forecast beyond 23rd was not there. Thank you for reminding me that, yeah, that's a significant thing, and I overlooked when I wrote my blog post on that one, yeah.
Third window was really a week after the 23rd, or almost a week. It was like five days later. And so they left 5 days before that window. So like they're looking at a forecast like 12, you know, 13, almost 2 weeks out. So it's pretty tough to forecast 2 weeks out what it's going to be like, especially when the weather can change within 3 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally, totally. In fact, Casey Groom, he was a guide when I was going on Rainier. I knew him from before. He was leading a Mike Hamill's team, and he went to the summit, and nobody was there, apparently. So he picked up a very late window. It's amazing, you know, like you go there and nobody, I think he went on 27th or 28th, very late. Few people had the mountain for themselves. It's amazing. So, and all that. And credit goes to Mingma, too, because Mingma, beautiful, he said, just let's follow the rope team. He said, like, as they're fixing, going from Camp 4 all the way to the summit, let's follow them. That was brilliant.
I got to thank Mingma because I was speaking to Rishi behind the scenes quite a bit.
And
Rishi didn't want to leave base camp until the fixed lines were in.
Right.
So I kind of pushed really hard to move up prior to the fixed lines being in because you had to or else you'd miss that first window.
Right.
And so the way I convinced Rishi was that if we were going to wait for the second window, we had finished our acclimatization fairly early. So that would have meant that we would have been in base camp waiting to climb for like 17 days. So we would have lost our acclimatization.
Yes.
So what I kind of pitched to Rishi was like, let's just go up. And then if the fixed lines don't get put in, let's go up to camp two. If the fixed lines aren't going to get put in, at least we're doing another acclimatization rotation.
Yes.
And then so either if the fixed lines are in, great, we'll go up. If they're not, then we'll come back down.
Yeah.
The second window, and we're still acclimatized.
Right.
And so he was kind of okay with that. And then I spoke to Mingma afterwards, and he really wanted to go up. So
right.
He was on my side. And so he was, I didn't realize it, but I was pushing Rishi, but he was pushing Rishi as well. So
right.
It worked out great. Like I can't say enough good things about Mingma. Mingma was fantastic.
Yeah, no, I look back and when I analyze all the decisions he made on the mountain, that's amazing. He's brilliant. I mean, I climbed with Lakpa too, who was your personal climber. I was with him in December. Lakpa is amazing. Lakpa is amazing.
I climbed with Lakpa for all three of my mountains in 2014. And so I didn't know who I was climbing with on Summit Day until right before we went to sleep. And Mingma came to my tent and he told me I was climbing with Lakpa, man. And I couldn't have been happier. Like I was ecstatic. I knew that we were going to have an awesome climb, and him and I had an awesome climb.
No, amazing. Lakpa is brilliant. He actually came with me, and I went from Lukla all the way to base camp in 6 days. So, in December, last year, December. And Lakpa called up to Rishi, and Rishi was in Europe, and he said, Srini, I approve. Srini should come to Everest, and he will be able to climb. It's bad that I fell sick, and my immune system became weak. My sinuses were not in place, and all those things went wrong. That's a whole different story. But then because of his observation of me, that Rishi put me on the trip. Otherwise, Rishi was like, man, you need to have more climbing experience, right? He was going there mentally in his mind. So, incredible. Mingma, Lakpa, both brothers are amazing. Many lessons that I personally took. If there is one more attempt in my lifetime, then I will have taken all that into account. In fact, Mingma told me to go run more, because I also met the other people who told me that, you need to run 10 miles a day. Now I'm shooting for 10 miles a day to really build up that endurance. So it's all good takeaways from the mountain. And I met some incredible people like you. And this has been a life-changing expedition for me personally. A lot of experiences, a lot of good people, a lot of lessons, and a lot of good takeaways.
Absolutely.
Clayton, thank you for your time. You know that you are in a very special place in my heart. I wish you all the best. Everything that you do from here on, I'm looking forward to our paths crossing in a very good way this time. This time will be very strong when it happens. And if there is one expedition and you are there leading the expedition, I want to be the guy who will be summiting at par with you on that summit, seriously. And I look forward to experiencing the climb with you at a higher level, which I couldn't do this time.
Absolutely.
Thank you, brother. You take care.
Hey, thank you for having me. And if you have any other further questions, don't hesitate to get me back on. I'll come back on your show anytime.
Thank you, brother. All the best to you.
Right on, Srini. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye now.